Welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Dr. Charlie Highmarch, and I'm an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's.
And I'm Stephen Archer. I'm a cardiology clinician scientist and the director of the Translational Institute of Medicine, which we affectionately call TIME.
In this series, we're fortunate to talk science and medicine with some of the most accomplished translational researchers from Queen's University and beyond. We want to know what their dangerous idea is, which is the concept that they're working on, which, if true, would change the direction of research or alter our understanding of medicine. We also want to find out a little bit about the person behind the discoveries. And in previous podcasts, we've sat down with clinicians and basic scientists, both from Queen's University and beyond, to discuss a diverse range of research topics that range from cancer research to studies of cardiovascular disease, bleeding disorders, and the impact of animal care on both human and animal well-being. We've even discussed particle physics with a Nobel laureate and healthcare reform with a former dean.
So today we're very fortunate to have Dr. Paul Koobs join us. Paul's a new faculty member at Queen's, although his story goes way back. Today he holds the Canada Excellence Research Chair, which is Canada's most prestigious research chair here at the university. But in the old days, after he moved from Montreal to go to school at Queen's University as an undergrad, he pursued his master's and PhD in cardiovascular physiology. It was interesting. He was, I understand, Paul, you were planning on heading off to Oxford University in the UK, but got excited by a talk you heard from a fellow from Louisiana State University, Dr. Granger, who was interested in microscopy to look at the blood vessels in living people and animals. And today you gave a fantastic medical grand rounds as part of the Time series on pointing microscopes at organs to understand human disease. So we'll be picking your brain a little bit more about your prestigious career in imaging the human body and conditions like ischemia reperfusion. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that after your training, you spent 33 incredibly productive years at the University of Calgary, where I knew you when I was at University of Alberta, and you led the Snyder Institute for Chronic Diseases there. So it's a great pleasure to have you here at Queen's. I'm delighted they recruited you, and I look forward to talking to you more. But before we get into all your research and your many accomplishments, I'd like to know your origin story. Like, how did you wind up in science? Was this predestined, or did you stumble into it? What's your background?
So my both my parents were at McGill University, and so it wasn't a matter of whether I'd go to university, but more where. I was preordained, and so off to university I went, and I've always been interested in biology and how things work, so that's how I ended up in sciences. It was an easy choice for me. I hated economics. I hated all those numbers and biology was just so very interesting to me.
How did a McGill boy find his way to Queen's University?
Well, so that was simple. I needed a place far enough away from McGill so I could be on my own, but close enough to do my laundry on the weekends. Yeah.
Well, I think we meet those criteria.
Wise, yeah, absolutely. So you were always on a trajectory for scientific research, or were you just kind of rolling the dice with an undergraduate and see whether you want to go medicine or research or something else?
I always was interested in research, for sure. And even in undergrad, I tried to do research. Not very well, but learned a little bit about research and found no reason not to do it for the rest of my life.
And who were the people at Queen's when you got to the master's and PhD level that inspired you to stay here as opposed to heading off?
Yeah, so Chris Chapler at the time was a cardiovascular physiologist and was kind enough to take me as an orphan. I was supposed to go to Western to work with someone on kidney disease, and he happened to get very ill, and so they had to retract their offer to me. I had no idea what I was going to do next. And Chris Chapler said, I'll take you. And he took me into his lab, and I spent 4 wonderful years doing research. And I think Chris taught me how to think. He kept asking me, well, why is that happening? And I kept struggling, but realized the value of that. Yeah.
It's funny how, as they say, when one door closes, I remember the reason I wound up in the United States was largely because the year I applied to the medical match, there was a postal strike and my application never got through. So I wound up defecting by default. So
serendipity often plays a role completely.
Yeah, that's right.
A little bit of luck and an opportunity. And I think for our undergraduates who are listening, you know, the concept that you had somebody to mentor you and to shelter you and take you on as an orphan, how important was that mentorship for your onward career as a researcher?
It was absolutely essential. You know, I was on the wrestling team at the time here at Queens. And so I spent a lot of time doing things I shouldn't have been doing. And Chris tolerated that. And he, as long as I showed up for work, he said, you know, one day you'll make this a priority. And I did. I did. He taught me how much fun science can be. I remember missing my last wrestling meet because I was getting ready for a talk on Monday morning. And so, you know, priorities change for you. And it was his doing. No question.
And were you any good at wrestling? Were you a good wrestler?
I was okay.
In your weight category?
Yeah, I was okay.
And then it is interesting, LSU, as I was saying at Grand Rounds this morning, is now known for its incredible women's basketball team. But that's not what took you there.
No, nor did Shaquille O'Neal, who was there at the time.
Really?
Yeah. So they had a pretty good basketball team then. You know, it was interesting. I was supposed to go to a Nobel Prize winner, Sir John Vane, in England. And I went to a talk in the States, and I loved the imaging so much that when I got home, I wrote a letter to Sir John Vane, and I said, I would very much like to stay and go and learn how to do imaging. And he was so very gracious. He wrote a letter to, at the time, MRC, CIHR, and explained to him that this young man wants to follow a dream and he should be allowed to. And so they transferred the CIHR fellowship to Dr. Neil Granger. And it was a wonderful experience.
Oh, that's amazing.
John Vane, my wife and I had lunch with him. He was got his Nobel Prize for the discovery of the prostacyclin pathway, which is an interesting connection to Salvador Moncada, who was the co-discoverer of that but didn't get the Nobel Prize, as Dr. Moncada also didn't get the Nobel Prize for being a co-discoverer of nitric oxide. So these prizes can be very fickle. But I remember when we were talking in preparation for this podcast, you told me there was something specific that you observed in the physiology lab about ischemia and reperfusion, stopping blood flow and then restarting it, which happens in many diseases in life. That inspired you to want to go into imaging. What can you tell us more about that?
Well, so I had no idea that if you reduce blood flow, I mean, I figured that wouldn't be very good for an organ. But when you reduce blood flow and then reperfuse, let the blood come back in, there's a swelling of the tissue that I would have never predicted. And it's spectacular. It's fast. It's robust. And I thought, wow. And so I started reading about it. And there was these hints that maybe the immune system gets upset when you reduce blood flow. And I thought, man, I got to learn more about this. And this fellow, Neil Granger, was trying to image it. He had this microscope. And he was an old-time cardiovascular physiologist, worked with Arthur Guyton, then started his own lab. And so I went down there and I started pointing the microscope at tissues that we could see through at the time. And now we can do heart, liver, lung. But at the time we used mesentery because it was nice and translucent. And we were able to see amazing things happen. The immune cells just came marching in during the reperfusion phase. And they were causing all the swelling. And so we started studying a lot of that.
Yeah, and it's interesting for those of you that want to Google Dr. Koobs and take a look at his research, you can briefly summarize it. It looks a lot like Pac-Man. I mean, this is if you know that old-fashioned game where the Pac-Man charges around the screen chasing after objects. These neutrophils that Paul has so elegantly imaged in various colors go through. So you have a colorful neutrophil, a white blood cell going through a colorful blood vessel of a different color, tracking down bacteria, other things, and sticking to walls and moving. And after ischemia reperfusion, the pictures you showed today were fantastic, looking at all these white cells just plugged vessels and sort of serve as little atomic bombs, releasing oxygen radicals and other toxic things that I guess drive the swelling.
Absolutely. And if you extend that to a heart, which is one of your favorite topics.
Very love dub.
Close to your heart, right?
I have to say love dub.
Yeah. You know, after a heart attack, you try and reperfuse before that tissue becomes necrotic. So you have to reintroduce blood flow if you can. And then you get this peripheral inflammation that's such a problem. And so I think there is, I would argue, there's really still a huge amount to discover around this, including a drug.
I think what's fascinating about your origin story is really how impactful that one lecture that you went to. And I think as academics, we often measure our worth in terms of H index and papers published, but actually the impact of that individual having an audience and picking one person's imagination out and then seeding an entire discipline that's come out of it, I think it's just a fantastic message for everyone about how impactful these things can be. So on this show, we like to ask researchers about their dangerous idea, which broadly speaking is the concept that you're working on, the overarching concept that you're working on, which, if true, would change the state of research as it is. Can you tell us about your dangerous idea?
Well, so it's the reason I came to Queens. I had this idea. I watch cancer immunotherapy. People take immune cells. They change them so the immune cell now can see a tumor, and then they plug them back in the body and hope that those immune cells find the tumor. Without giving it a GPS, without giving it a map, how's that cell supposed to find that tumor? And for 35 years, I've been studying how immune cells find sites, and every site has a different postal code. The tumor doesn't have a postal code. So how is that immune cell, unless it gets really, really lucky, ever going to stumble across the tumor? And so my dangerous idea is to come here and work with the cancer biologists, harvest immune cells that go to the gut exclusively, make them into CAR T cells, immunotherapy cells, get them go to gut tumors. If we need them to go to a lung tumor, we take the immune cells from that should go to the lung and make them into CAR T cells. So give them a GPS so they can find their way to the tumor.
They become like precision missiles.
Exactly. And that's what's missing right now. And so people are stunned when they take all the immune cells, stick it into a body, and the person develops inflammation of the gut, inflammation of the heart, instead of killing the tumor. And many of these therapies don't work because of all these nasty side effects. We got to find a better way of doing that.
It's interesting in the movies that you show during your lectures, it is interesting when you watch a couple of immune cells or a platelet and an immune cell or a platelet, an immune cell and a bacteria all in the same field. They clearly know who's in their environment and who's in their neighborhood and that kind of homing. So it's not just these immune cells wandering aimlessly, like they're like a little army of cells and they're programmed to follow chemical signals, some of which you were saying come from the mitochondria, near and dear to my heart. But they follow these signals, and sometimes they don't have a signal, and that's what you're working on with the CAR-T program. And we've had Dr. Annette Hay on this podcast, and Annette talked about this idea of reprogramming your own cells to attack your tumor. You're basically saying, but wait, they need to know how to get to the tumor.
So Annette and I are working closely together because we're just going to take that idea and my idea and merge them. We can try and give them a GPS, but the body already has given them a GPS. We just have to take advantage of it. So, you know, I can pluck an immune cell out of the gut, put it back in the bloodstream, and it's back in the gut before I know it. They know, and they know how to get back there. So if we can harness the GPS that's already in these immune cells, we can then direct them.
Hack the existing infrastructure, make your life easy.
Yeah.
I say easy.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll work. Yeah.
So we normally ask you to take these complicated explanations of how you're going to kill cancer cells by putting a GPS in the immune cells so they can target them for a high school student. And why don't you give that a shot and see? Just pretend Charlie and I are in high school, which won't be
a stretch. Use small words for us.
Yeah. So it's interesting, high school. So how do I get to high school? Well, I seemed to get lost every time I went to high school. I didn't have a GPS. I didn't have a map. And so I wandered around aimlessly. I was late for class. I always got in trouble. So that's a bad thing.
Sounds like a motivation problem.
And so what I want to do is I want to get the immune cell and understand how it gets to where it's going. How does it know that there's a little infection in your little finger, and yet it's somewhere in the heart? How does it get from there to the little finger? And it's not the only one. It brings all its friends. And how do they get there? And how do they attack that bacterium and kill it? And so how does this cell that's nowhere near the high school, know where the high school is, and gets to it just fine. That's always amazed me, and that's what I'm trying to do, is understand those processes.
And it sounds like those cells have a social media network that basically lets it be known that there's a party on the little finger, and away we go.
Yeah, and you know, we make a lot of cells because we want to populate the whole body with cells, but then the second one cell realizes there's a problem, it releases or phones up its buddies via phone. It happens in little packets of molecules that brings the next cell in, that brings its friend in, that brings its friend in. And pretty soon you've got a swarm of cells. And that's what you need to kill a bacterium.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. So it made it actually much easier for everyone to understand, I think. Okay, well, thank you for that. So we're going to move more away from success and away from big ideas and actually come back to the bumps in the road, because, of course, success is usually the consequence of multiple failures. So we ask our guests to tell us a little bit about a bump in the road that they may have experienced and maybe how they overcame that and, you know, how your success has been driven from your failure.
So as a scientist, and as all of us in this room and everybody in this university, we all get a rejection. We all get told, no, your paper's not good enough. No, your grant's not good enough. When I first started, I got my first rejection. It was devastating. Like, how could I possibly be rejected? My ideas aren't good enough. How am I ever going to make it in this field? And, you know, the next day I was working on my rebuttal. And I was going to show them. And I think that I learned that from my parents, is you don't take no for an answer. You don't give up. We all get rejections. And if we don't accept them for what they are, which is you need to improve and you better improve, and then you take that opportunity to improve, you're going to wind up failing. And so I think that all the students out there, they'll get a rejection, whether it be to medical school, whether it be their first paper, whether it be their first grant, fellowship. You can't let that, it's water off the back. You just get on with it. Listen to what the reviewer's at to say. Often it's very informative, but get on with life. Yeah, don't dwell on it.
Yeah, I think that's an important message. When we were prepping for this podcast, I was asking you about your pet peeves, and one was rejection. And I think, you know, for the listeners, Dr. Koob's papers, he's written hundreds of them, have been cited about 90,000 times. So that's a big number in our field of biology. So people are reading his work, and you therefore think, maybe if you're not in the business, that means it's all easy. You just have an idea, do the experiment, write it down, send it in, and it gets published. But in fact, your number one complaint was rejection, and reviewer three. And maybe you can just tell the listeners, what do you mean by reviewer three?
Yeah. So, you know, what happens is you submit your grant to the government, or you submit your paper to a journal, and then you usually get two reviewers. And if there are opposing views, if one says, this is a great paper, and the other one says, yeah, I'm not really sure I like it, it goes to reviewer three. And reviewer three is often the assassin, as I can tell. They're usually the one that really piles on. And so while often you can address reviewer one and reviewer two, reviewer three often is the big stumbling block.
And it deals the fatal blow.
Yes, yes.
Amen. Well, normally we ask you about the crystal ball, and we could do that if you want to look at the future. But you told a story this morning at Rounds that I think our listeners would be fascinated by. You had a surgeon come to you from Switzerland, an abdominal surgeon, and he walks into your office looking for a research project prepared to do surgery in your lab, and you confront him with a sea urchin. And so what can the connection between abdominal surgery and sea urchins possibly be?
Yeah. So I went to this meeting, and the individual who was organizing the meeting was a fellow named Charlie Janeway, one of the best immunologists of all time. And he brought in a guy to speak about sea urchins. And I thought, what the heck is going on? And the sea urchin's been around for 500 million years, lives in the dirtiest waters, and yet it thrives. And the reason it does is it has a single immune cell divided into little subparts, but immune cell that when you pierce a hole in the sea urchin, this immune cell and all of its friends plug that hole so that nothing can leak in. And they do it instantaneously. And if you think about us, we have a cavity just like the sea urchin, our abdomen. And so this fella came to work with me, and I told him that I thought, much like the sea urchin, in him and I, if we ever got an injury, these immune cells would rush to that area and fix it. And while I was telling the story about the sea urchin, I guess he was a little impatient. So he got up and he looked to make sure he was right in the right office. And he really didn't want to hear about sea urchins. And in the end, he published probably one of my most, impactful papers on what started as a sea urchin story and ended up curing a disease, an post-operative disease in patients. So normally our immune system tries to help us heal, but sometimes it forms scars. And after abdominal surgery, you get scars. And these immune cells were causing these scars. And so we've now got a company and we're trying to find ways of treating these scars.
And for listeners who might be patients, you'll hear your doctor call those adhesions. So these are not the scars that form on your belly wall on the outside. These are fibrotic bands that form inside where they can't be seen, but they can twist the bowel and obstruct it and cause major problems, either chronic pain or bowel obstruction that are known complications that occur. I know, I'd say, 5% or 10% of people?
Yeah, you know, it's not clear what percentage, because it may be as much as 90%, but only 5% come to see their clinician.
Their doc, yeah.
Yeah. So we don't know what the percentage is. We know that 5% come back because they can't get on with life. Mm. Their bowel's twisted. That's an emergency operation. But, you know, some of them just feel so much pain that they want relief. And so it's tough, yeah.
It's a humbling lesson, which, again, you mentioned in your lecture this morning about humility when it comes to talking about the word relevance. So another critique of people's science is that's not relevant. You're talking about a K-channel. You're talking about a mitochondria. You're talking about some homing signal for an immune cell, not relevant to health. But you never know what's actually going to prove to be relevant. And curiosity-driven science is hard to get funded, but it has huge impact.
Often it's what we weren't looking for that has the biggest impact when you find it.
So before we wrap this podcast up, we'd like to our audience to get to know a little bit about you, the person behind the discovery. So we've got a few silly questions that we're going to use just to kind of like trying to probe and find out a little bit about you. And you've only had preparation for one of these, but tell me what your favorite meal is and can you cook that dish yourself?
So without doubt, my favorite meal is a Czech meal that's called svíčková. It's a stew with dumplings and soft meat. And I used to be able to make it myself. And here's a plug for a soccer friend of mine who started a restaurant who now can make that. He's a Czech guy. And so I go out there and have that meal so I don't have to cook it anymore myself.
Is that a restaurant in Kingston?
It's in Gananoque.
Oh, okay. Well, that's local enough.
So he's a Czech, but his restaurant is called The Maple Leaf. The best Czech food.
I've been there. It's
yes.
Very good.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Right on the main street as you go through.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about music, so we can certainly come to that. But I just from chatting you today, tell us about your house and what condition your house is in.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a big hole.
So we have with us a Canada Excellence Research Chair who's basically unhoused.
Yeah.
So you're aspiring to have a house at some point.
Yeah.
You know, winter's coming, Paul.
Yeah. I don't want to get upset about it. You just have to go. It's another rejection. So.
Maybe I should ask you about music.
Yes.
What's your favorite music genre and can you play?
Can I play? I can't play. I can't sing. I like listening, though. And so I like the old-time rock folks, Bruce Springsteen, you know, people like that, that I've always enjoyed that kind of rock, just sitting back and listening. Yeah,
yeah, I like a dad rock. I've got up with you. I hear he's the boss anyway. So.
Yeah.
My next question is, what's the strangest job that you ever had, apart from this one?
Yeah, so we live in different times, but in 1988, I was in charge, and maybe we'll cut this, but I was in charge of being the bouncer at a golf club, and my job was to keep the wives from coming into the pub because they wanted to get their husbands out. That, by far, the weirdest job.
Oh, my.
I think we'll leave it in. I think it's good for us to remember our history. It may explain why people are a little concerned about feminism not being as advanced as it needs to be. So,
yeah, that was 88.
That's a great answer.
And it was a weird job.
It was, indeed.
So if you could travel in time, would you go back or forward?
Oh, that's a good question. I probably want to have a sneak peek at what's going to happen. So I'd go forward. I'd like to see, and I hope that we get better, not worse.
I know. I always used to believe we were. I'm going to say every time I turn on CNN, it challenges that belief. Like you, I'd like to know that.
Okay, so last question, and this is my favorite question, and hopefully you've got a good answer for me. If you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
There's so many good choices. You got everything from like Bugs Bunny.
All the Marvel characters. You can go pretty wide on this.
Oh, man, I would want to be Thor. That guy with the hammer, that is so cool.
No, I hear you.
People listen to him.
He's a real genuine authority. Yes. I can see that.
Yeah, so that sounds like a good choice.
Okay, so Dr. Tubes, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to our audience today. And to our listeners, I would like to thank you for taking time to get to know Dr. Tubes with us, and we hope that you enjoyed the show. And if you have enjoyed this episode or would like to know more about research at Queen's University, or indeed share this podcast with friends or relatives, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Dr. Tubes, thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.